xraycause.org.
You're listening to X-Ray FM, KXRY Portland at 91.1 on your FM dial. K296 FT, West Haven serving Portland at 107.1 on your FM dial. And K219 KU, Nahalem serving the Oregon coast at 91.7 on your FM dial. Streaming live and archive, baby, at xray.fm. Radio is yours.
Today on Wings, we return to the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet, Miami, 1991, for the conclusion of Wings' documentary, Agenda to Save the Planet. Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
It almost gets to be tiresome to have to continue and repeat, as we do, that women must be part of decision making. But if we keep saying it long enough and act upon it, as we're trying to do here, it will come about.
Former U.S. Congresswoman Bella Abzug convened 1,500 women from 83 countries to prepare a consensus document about what women want to see on the agenda of the June 1992 United Nations Conference on Environment and Development. A resolution calling for equal participation by women was the first item agreed upon by the participating nations. Now the issue is whether this was only lip service.
We're not going to ask for much. But for starters, a lot of talk has been made here about women's participation in decisions. So we suggest no more than 60% or less than 40% of either sex should be included in leadership posts in the United Nations, its specialized agencies and programs, in governments and public policy making groups in every region in the world, and especially in the member delegations that go to Rio in June. We're not going to ask for much. We only think we should get about half of international development funds and resources allocated to women's programs and projects in developing countries in compensation for 46 years of underfunding the needs of women and children, the poorest of the poor. We're not going to ask for much. We're going to ask for a very important thing, and that is that unless and until men and women together share in the responsibilities, share in the obligations, and share in the rights and the production and distribution in this world will not be able to continue.
Rosalie Bertel, a Canadian epidemiologist, was one of 15 experts who formally testified at the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet. She was one of many whose testimony helped shape the Women, Militarism, and the Environment section of the 71-point Women's Action Agenda.
It's our earth. It's all we have. It's our air. It's our water. It's our food. It's babies. It's the future. And it has been seriously damaged and seriously jeopardized, which is why we are here. And I like the analogy of the bathtub, and I would like to put the plug in, because we can't keep running the water and having it run out. And I think the plug is the military, that we have to deal with that.
We demand nuclear weapons be dismantled and destroyed, that nuclear testing cease immediately. We've got lots more in this lot. We demand that space activities and supersonic flight, which threatens the ozone layer or releases carbon dioxide, cease. We urge an immediate 50% reduction in military spending. We demand creation of national civilian commissions with 50% membership of women, which would open to public scrutiny all military activities, expenditures, and research and development. We demand that national armies be converted into environmental protection corps, which would monitor and repair damage to natural systems, including cleanup of military bases, and be available to assist citizens in times of natural and man-made disasters. We condemn governments that turn their armies against their citizens, leading millions of individuals to become refugees and displaced persons. And we will educate our daughters and sons to shun military service if it is in the service of governments which use military power to exploit the resources and people of other nations.
All the wars of the military-industrial complex, the bombs dropped there, now we're dying of cancer, the chickens are coming home to roost in our own environment.
While the wars have been fought, and we are supposedly at peace, the casualties of war are here. We are the casualties of war, especially the ones that live around the military facilities. And we're not recognized as such. But we are the ones that they experiment on first for the nuclear weapons and for all the weapons that they're making. And we are the ones that are, there's women that are bathing their babies in Rocky Mountain flats that have nerve gas products in their water.
The way we unmask the wolf in sheep's clothing is to find if they bring us poison, to find if they bring us sickness, to find if they bring us death. And we must uncover it. And we must demand accountability and destruction and elimination of this whole secret military system, which destroys our Earth and its livability. I think women are going to have to take the initiative, and women's groups are going to have to take the initiative to look at their own nation and to begin to issue report cards, to begin to say, are we going in the right direction or are we deteriorating? And if we are deteriorating, why? So one of the things that we're calling for political action is to begin to critically rate our own nations in terms of five things. One is the health of the natural environment. The second thing we'd like to look at is the health of the value system, which is motivating and driving our nation. The third thing is the health of the political system and the participatory nature of our nations. What kind of marks would they get? The fourth is the health of resource distribution and the households of our nation. And the last and fifth is the health of our human development systems. And I think the things we care about fall into all five categories. And I must thank Eva Nordland from Norway for pulling together the report card system and giving it life and bringing it to this conference.
We hope that someday, pretty soon, we will not only have a UN Security Council for military questions, but a UN Health Security Council. And we women can bring from all the countries in the world our report cards, what the progress is in our countries relating to the political system, the value system, the natural system, and our children and our old people. So this is the idea. Thank you very much.
Just a short question on the report cards about which you talked just now. Some of them seem to require a little more specialized knowledge to answer. So what sort of groups do you have in mind for filling in these report cards?
The report cards have two parts. One is a general overall estimate of your nation. You know, do we have problems in the area of our value system or our politics? And is anything being done about it? Has there been any progress? Are there efforts? Do we rate fairly well in this? And are we improving and are we sharing? There is a second section which is more quantified, which has to do with how much literacy in our country. What is the equity between genders in our country? How many people have shelter? How many people are malnourished? And so on. So there are some attempts also to quantify the health of our nation and to put these together to find the health of our region, the health of our world. Because it's only if we make progress on every one of these fronts that we will have a healthy planet.
We have to clear up the mess, so to speak, and therefore we have a right to question the people who created the mess. Should we also not insist that those who created the mess themselves clean it up also?
One of the five judges of the tribunal, Justice Sujata Manohar from the Bombay High Court, questions witness Peggy Antrobus, a development specialist from Barbados.
You asked, shouldn't the people who create the mess clean it up themselves? Yes, I mean, that is one of the things that... But if you ask the industrialists who are creating the mess to clean it up, it costs them more money, it'll affect their profits, and that is where the resistance comes from, because they're not prepared to do that.
We call for the creation of a permanent UN Environmental Commission to serve as an ombudsperson, receive individual complaints, monitor compliance, and enforce principles of an international code of environmental ethics. We require all states and corporations who produce toxic chemical agents to dispose of their toxic waste within their own borders.
On Wings, you're listening to Voices and Ideas from the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, another witness, is a former finance minister of Liberia and worked on trade issues for the World Bank.
Disproportionate distribution of and access to world resources has served to keep a few countries rich, very rich, and the majority of countries poor, very poor.
Jacqueline Pitangui, former president of the National Council of the Rights of Woman, Brazil.
I just wanted to bring another perspective to the discussion. It's not exactly a question, but I think that we have to think of logics and what kind of logics are going on maximization of profit and maximization of chances of survival. We cannot talk of environment without considering that the poor people, and the poor people, which is the majority of the population in our countries, they are maximizing their chances of survival because there is a maximization of profit going on the economic values and on the market values. But the logic is the same. It's at the expenses of the nature. And it's to guarantee their survival today that they have to cut the trees, they have to put earth on an ecosystem and build a house there, or the floods will come and will destroy because there was deforestation. And I think that the North has pointed a finger to us too much, as though the poverty was not considered. So I think that North and South are linked by this logic of maximization of profit, which is perverse. It is a perverse trend because there is maximization of profit at the expenses of nature, which leads to the need to maximize the chances of survival also at the expenses of nature. And I think those two questions have to be considered when we talk about the value of ecosystems and find the measures to deal with it.
We call for the renegotiation of terms of trade that will ensure an equitable relationship between the price of raw materials and prices of manufactured goods.
A creative approach to trade imbalance and third world debt came out of discussion in a workshop.
I'd like to suggest, as a member of the third world, that one of the things for us that would equate the present debt we carry is if you did an environmental audit historically. We do an audit of the ecosystems as they existed in 1940s after the war. We see where they are, we see who the user was, and we see who the net beneficiary was. And if we can get a net beneficiary assessment, then for Guyana, we will know that Canada made money off of our bauxite, Britain made money out of our lumber, so-and-so made money out of thing, and maybe we can cancel our debt just based on that.
We suggest that historic audits of nation states from 1945 onward be conducted to determine the net beneficiaries of natural resource exploitation, an assessment which would serve as the basis of to cancel current debt.
Foreign debt is a matter of crucial importance to women in developing countries because it is being used by the World Bank and International Monetary Fund to force cuts in public services. Every lost daycare center or public bus or hospital bed or food subsidy or public sector job forces more unwaged work on women, whose contribution to sustaining life isn't counted in the gross domestic product.
We call for the rejection of structural adjustments policies, SAPs, which shift the responsibilities of basic social services from governments to women without compensation or assistance.
Nancy Barry is on leave from the World Bank to serve as president of Women's World Banking, which helps poor women start their own lending institutions.
What structural adjustment lending is balance of payment support, essentially in exchange for governments changing their macroeconomic policies and opening up their economies and reforming their financial systems and privatizing their public enterprises. The World Bank talks a lot about the supply response. Basically, the supply response means that economies grow, that exports improve, that poor people increase their income. And in order for that to happen, you cannot expect that you change the exchange rate, liberalize imports, and the rest will take care of itself. I mean, that is an absurd proposition. One of the things that the World Bank really needs to worry about now is getting more people at the technical level and at the managerial level who are not macroeconomists. One of the problems in going through 10 years of the macroeconomist as king is that even when the World Bank figures out, as it has internally, that structural adjustment has not worked terribly well and certainly not the way it was done, those are the people that are still running the show.
The ludicrous inadequacy of current economic theory was the text of testimony by Marilyn Waring, a well-known feminist economist and former member of New Zealand's parliament.
First of all, the boys are calling a whole new field of study ecological economics. It's a bit of a problem with eco, of course, the Greek derivation from home, the way the boys treat ecological economics, it doesn't have a great deal to do with home. It uses, as it would be suggested, conventional economic tools despite all the caveats which the boys enter about how these are not really appropriate and it's very difficult to cram them all into one system, etc. For those of you who aren't up with the play, growth is anything that passes through the market for which cash is exchanged. There isn't a debit side of growth, so it's not like running the housekeeping. And there isn't a legal or illegal demarcation either, so that it's really good for growth to smoke lots of cigarettes, have lots of car accidents. Wars are sensational. A few eggs on Valdez's into icebergs are extremely good. I don't know why people worry about Noriega. I mean, illegal drugs are what a lot of the South even produces to even get any form of growth rate.
Waring's testimony brought about resolutions calling for differentiation between constructive and destructive production, and another opposing environmental accounting. Marilyn Waring.
We must fight very hard what is happening. The United Nations Statistical Office has already approved the establishment of environmental accounts inside the system of national accounts. They will involve the commodification of everything that can be perceived as having a market value. But these things are nightmares because, of course, national income accounting works inside nation states. And one of the things that nature can teach us, thankfully, is that it doesn't know anything about nation state boundaries. Is acid rain going to be recorded as a natural export to Canada? And quite where is Canada going to record this now in its income accounts? And the same for Norway. Is it going to think that it just got some aid from the UK when the next lot of acid rain hits? Or, you know, where is it quite supposed to pop it? And in the Pacific, when the French exploded another bomb in Mururoa, and we would just like to send it home to Paris, but it doesn't work like that. When we get our dead fish and our jelly babies and our leukemia, just quite where are we supposed to record this in our national income accounts? So I have some trouble with the fact that we even think that we can number crunch it inside a nation state context. But the inability to attribute a market value to part of the ecosystem doesn't mean that it's not worthy of consideration. But the treatment of the environment in national accounts and in public policy reproduces the arrogant ideology that only money is of value and only the market is a source of knowledge.
The Secretary General of the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development attended the final plenary of the Congress. He heard the statement by the five judges who weighed the formal testimony.
Secretary General Morris Strong and honored guests, I want to introduce them to you individually. The Honorable Justice Elizabeth Ebert from Australia, the Justice Desiree Bernard of Guyana, Justice Siyata V. Manohar from India, Lady Justice F.E.U.R. from Kenya, and Judge Margareta Wattstein of Sweden. I now call upon the Honorable Justice Elizabeth Evatt of Australia to render the decision of the tribunal.
If I could turn now to what we've called the declaration of the tribunal of the Miami World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet. We believe that to tackle the problems that have identified by the many speakers here at this Congress, the actions of state governments, international agencies, private organizations and individuals should be guided by three basic principles. They are, first, global equity, second, resource ethics, and third, empowerment of women. As to global equity, the global environment is the necessary condition of life. As such, it cannot be the exclusive preserve of any individual. the principle of equity should guide states individually and collectively in determining who has access to and use of basic resources. The first priority should be given to meeting the basic human rights and needs of all people, especially the right of everyone to an adequate standard of living, including adequate food, clothing and housing, and to the continuous improvement of living conditions. I quote there from the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. Those principles should guide financial and economic policies. The second principle, resource ethics. The use of natural resources should be guided by ethical principles which balance the need for material progress with the sustainability of resources and which base living standards on long-term sustainability and on responsibility towards future generations. The third principle is the empowerment of women. The women's perspective, which recognizes that meeting human and social needs is a goal of higher importance than economic progress for its own sake, must be brought to bear on global problems of environmental destruction and poverty arising from inequitable access to necessary survival resources. Women must be empowered at all levels to contribute to the achievement of the principles of equity, social justice, and ethics.
In responding to the women's agenda, Secretary General Strong pointed out it would be difficult to get substantive results from the Earth Summit in Brazil. Magda Renner, spokesperson on environment for Brazil's National Confederation of Women, offers advice for the event.
I have been for 2 years at the NGO World Bank Committee and always behaving very well and writing hundreds of papers and making thousands of suggestions, which then always were considered very enlightening, but nothing happened. But when we went into the streets with our big banners, standing in New York where it was forbidden to stay, and the police came, then it was an affair, and then suddenly all those men started listening to what we were saying. So we must be visible when all the dignitaries, the powerful men are coming to Brazil in Rio de Janeiro. We must be there, we must be standing in the streets. We must be crying out at them. We don't not behaving so well as we always do, just standing there. Yeah, it's true. Just standing, just hearing, and not having the possibility to speak. So if we don't have the possibility to speak during the official meetings, let us stand in the streets where those men have to pass to go into their beautiful cars. And let us make our demonstrations there.
Give us back our rainforest in the heart of the Amazon. Give us back our oceans pure as they were when the world was young. Give us back our air so sweet that the beat on nature runs. Let the hungry child be fed the sand and love.
This concludes the two-part documentary, Agenda to Save the Planet, produced by Frieda Worden and funded by Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. For more about WINGS, check our website, www.wings.org, or email wings@wings.org. The Old Wings sound logo you heard in this show was created by Maggie Payne. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Support for X-Ray FM comes from Spielman Bagels and Coffee. Opened by Rick Spielman and his son Raph, Spielman's has been serving handmade boiled and baked bagels and house-roasted coffee since 2011 in their flagship store located on Southeast 20th and Division Street. More information and hours at SpielmanBagels.com.
This is Angle of View. Today is April 28th, 2026. I'm Will Hatman. Angle of View Classics Week 2. Good to great movies about art and artists. Let's go. The Fabelmans, 2022, directed by Steven Spielberg. Review date, September 28th, 2024. Second viewing. The Fabelmans makes artists look like the compulsives that they are without asking you to pity them. It makes them look like the mystics they are without asking you to worship them. It demonstrates the ordinary toil that art practices demand without asking you to be impressed by it. It shows you where artists get their inspiration from without explaining everything away. It shows both edges of the art life sword, how art demands that the artist gather their life into something expressible while requiring that they detach from that life in order to do it. An artist who starts as a child will be pained more than anyone by this cost for the way it distorts and sometimes reduces the social experiences, both in family and among peers, that are so vital to child development and that the child wants to have. Their friends and family will either not understand what they do or why they do it, or they will love what they do but be pained at having to share them with it. The Fabelmans draws pictures of all these traps with amazing care and tenderness, while stepping nimbly around all the many traps set out for it. And the fact that it's a film about an artist whose medium is film opens it to that rare meta-narrative level of engagement that actually intensifies your emotional appreciation. Besides the delight of warm hug jokes like the adjustment of the final shot, and when Sammy says, "Unless I make a movie about it someday," there's, e.g., the immense pathos added to the scene of Sammy imagining in the moment how he would shoot the scene of his parents' divorce announcement that is achieved when you think about the real Spielberg imagining how to shoot all of it. The idea of film as Spielberg's personal language, the only way he can really express himself, is what creates all the most powerful connections both within the film and through it. An example of the former is Michelle Williams' abject crawl out of the closet after she has watched Sammy's film of her betrayal. And for the latter, we have the immense shadow cast behind Paul Dano in his one good performance ever as he feels himself vanish while staring at that cookout photo. These are the moments that make Spielberg's intentions clearest. The movie is as complex and spiky as the experience of growing up, but because he needed to break away from his family in order to become the artist he was born to be, he is compelled to return now as that artist, in his language, to press his parents and his sisters close to his heart. Call it a love letter to movies, I wouldn't say you were wrong. But it's at least as beautiful as an overdue thank you card to his family for giving him the inspiration, both warm and cold, to make movies, as well as the means, both generous and grudging, and then finally letting him go off and make them. The title, after all, is not Sammy. Inside Llewyn Davis, 2013, directed by Joel and Ethan Coen. Review date, December 21st, 2024. Second viewing. The agonies of being a middling talent, of being just good enough that you convinced yourself to keep trying, and of ultimately discovering after many sunk costs the distance between your feeling that you were put on this earth to be an artist and those of everyone else. The movie itself even seems at first to believe that Llewyn is great and destined. Its gaze toward him is nothing short of adoring when he performs, but it's just the desperation of his ego rubbing off on the frame. You can't deny that there's something missing during his performances. He gets 3 uninterrupted songs, 4 if you count Please Mr. Kennedy, and numerous littler moments. The camera gives him all the support it possibly can, and still it's just not happening. There's no magic. It's not simply a matter of him not fitting into Bud Grossman's commercial idea of what a performer should be. He's a dull performer, pretty and tame. And that duo he had with his more talented dead friend was his best shot. He knows it, too. He knows his mediocrity is the main reason that the national folk music discovery phenomenon currently in progress is passing him over. And he pontificates about integrity and lashes out at his fellows to soothe his wounded pride whenever he gets a fresh taste of his insubstantiality. He does this even though he desires recognition and the material rewards that come with it just as much as any of those supposed poseurs. And this frustration is what's driving his anger. And he is bitterly aware of the hypocrisy which only wounds his pride further. These conflicts are just intolerable, and the grisly experience of reckoning with them fills him with shame. The saddest line in this very sad movie is, "I thought I just needed a night's sleep, but it's more than that." Most artists aren't as socially inept and mean as Llewyn Davis, nor probably as unlucky. But in socioeconomic as well as psychological terms, the lived experience of probably about 90% of artists is something like this. And of course, these are precisely the people you don't hear about unless you know or are one yourself. Possibly only the Coens would think this story was worth telling, just as only they would manage to give Llewyn the full measure of his humanity without even grazing the temptation to candy him up so that you'll like him. I don't know if any other filmmakers of their generation had a greater gift for characterization. And the fact that Inside Llewyn Davis is short on the butter and sugar of their most beloved movies, plot, violence, broad humor, only makes the amazingly subtle, textured development of the main character more perceptible. It's like a perfect charcoal drawing. It's on that strength, which extends through to Oscar Isaac's bilious double-knotted performance, that incredibly it's not just as moving but as entertaining as any of their bigger movies. Pollock, 2000, directed by Ed Harris. Review date December 17th, 2023. Second viewing. Pollock is most marvelous as an actor's showcase, but it's one of those rare actor's showcases which, after distinguishing itself as such by being its lead actor's first directing credit, actually satisfies as a well-directed movie. Harris is truly hard-edged in how he pushes this exquisite and delicately arranged cast. He's treating beautiful sculptures like action figures, and none more toughly than himself. And it pays off. It's glorious work from everyone. Marcia Gay Harden's performance is probably one of the least actually seen performances ever to win an Academy Award, and it's because those who did see it could not shake it off. I laughed when this was first released, and before I had seen it, because it seemed like Harris might plausibly have chosen his subject by asking himself what historical figure he physically resembled the most strongly, and simply going from there. But besides how risible it would be for anybody to take that approach to anything, the paintings themselves are so central to the story that nobody lacking in real love for the work could have made the movie. In fact, it seems that a desire to investigate the paintings on film, more so than the man who made them, was the actual primary motivation, which is the correct spirit. The bottomless eternity held in those paintings is why we care. They are treated with the right note of curiosity, just enough to leaven the reverence. The primal power is felt on the canvas, and we are meant to feel it spill over into the scenes, and the real trick is that it manages to create that feeling of spillage while delicately sidestepping the worst of the stormy artist biopic banalities, namely the suggestion that artistic genius is a force which cannot help but cause suffering to the people in the artist's life, that emotional abusiveness is the other side of the creativity coin. This movie sees Jackson Pollock's abuse as primarily a product of his alcoholism, and his alcoholism as a mysterious condition with no definitive source, which is just how it really is in life. There is never a suggestion that his paintings depended on his booze or his cruelty. If anything, it's the opposite. He paints his best when clean. And the movie never lets him off the hook for the many steps he took near the end to increase his investment in booze and cruelty at the cost of painting. It's not easy to hold all these elements and avoid cliché. There are a few of the kinds of pat, conveniently crystalline convergence moments that biopics can't resist putting in, e.g. the discovery of the drip and Lee Krasner's extemporaneous lecture on cubism. But apart from that, it doesn't give that annoying feeling of hitting the expected beats at the expected rhythm. We have an unusually good laconic screenplay, as such things go, from Barbara Turner and Susan Emshwiller to thank for this. But also Harris has a clear-headed film sense. It may not be visionary, but it's extremely firm. He's got serious talent surrounding him. Lisa Rinsler's lighting is consistently magnificent and thrummingly dramatic, no matter the setting. But his grasps of the shot and of editing rhythms are absolutely there. He clearly paid attention on set and on stage before that. A lot of his presentation choices are theater-derived and totally digestible because the editing integrates them so well. It's not all great. Jeff Beal's score is a blight. Nowhere near close to the core instability of the story, and I don't know where that GeoCities typeface in the credits came from. The first 90 seconds are nothing but that typeface and that music, and you wonder if you're being pranked. Also, more seriously, a few of the scenes, the concluding car crash, the Thanksgiving table flip before it, and an ill-advised dolly zoom so conspicuous that you'll absolutely know it when you see it, are simply overdone, Harris having squeezed the elements too hard. Just as Pollock did? Too passionate to be contained? Huh? Things just can't help but get soppy after that much sustained release. As is typical of drama, it's when it's partly holding itself in that it's punching the hardest. Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters, 1985, directed by Paul Schrader. Review date September 14th, 2024, second viewing. It's always risky to make a biopic about an artist, for the reason that you will be expected to connect the substance of the artist's life with the substance of their work somehow, and this requirement invites you into a minefield. A movie that avoids the responsibility will be considered incurious, and rightly so, but 9 out of every 10 that take it on will make connections too few, too obvious, too simplistic, or too inflated, and risk being called reductive. Paul Schrader, in this movie so unlike any of his others, yet so like them at the same time, gets somewhere with Yukio Mishima by slotting dramatizations of some of his major works in with reenactments of some of his life's major episodes, and, in order to make the choice resonate, cutting the story of his life unapologetically down to the few ideas that were in charge at the end. You can cite this as a case of the work calling itself reductive before anyone else can, but it vibrates so furiously in its tight little container that it comes off more like a necessary winnowing, sage and possibly brilliant. Rather than trying to capture the whole man, it's capturing the legend, the persona. And actually, of that, it's concerned principally with a certain chunk, the story of the artist who became increasingly obsessed with the limitations of art's expressive power, at the same time as both his art and his life began to narrow toward a reactionary traditionalist politics. This is the aspect of the Mishima legend that got Paul Schrader's gears turning. He's always been magnetized by stories of repressed men who finally seek to purify themselves with violence. And the fact of Mishima's philosophical narrowness at the end of his life invites a narrower movie by begging for an understanding of how that narrowing occurred. It's a precious match of artist, subject, and form. Moreover, the dramatizations being so self-aware as such, embracing theater conventions, and being filmed in oversaturated color with Philip Glass arpeggios trilling high and ecstatic in the mix, insists that you make the connections poetically, even sensually, rather than intellectually. Benediction, 2022, directed by Terrence Davies. Review date December 8th, 2022. First and only viewing. An exquisitely languid and intimate portrait of a good man, poet Siegfried Sassoon, bent into permanent anger by two unjust forces. The dehumanizing brutality of World War I, which gave him scars in his youth that he kept forever, and Britain's criminalization of homosexuality, which robbed him of any chance at true personal peace once that first horror had passed. It's a shame that this was my first Davies, not only because it means that I lacked that access of context for assessing this one, but because it's clear I've been missing out on a very special artist. Note, I have caught up on some past Davies since this date, and they're all really good. And he's died since then. R.I.P. His talent for writing dialogue is exceeded only by his talent for directing it. The words almost certainly sparkle on the page, but they positively burst into flames on camera for the way Davies paces their delivery and modulates the actor's pitch and volume. It's amazing that he doesn't have a theater background, as it's been years since I watched an original dramatic film that demonstrated such a mastery of speech. Every two-person scene in particular was thrummingly alive, no matter the emotional tenor, and this movie touches them all. Naturally, the actors deserve enormous credit for this, too. Many of them I'd never had the pleasure of watching before, and they all swept me away, especially Jack Loudon, our choleric, stultified lead, who seems in every scene like he's trying to hold his breath to keep from drowning. It would appear from interviews that Davies saw a lot of himself in Sassoon, and I certainly think that only someone of similar temperament could have done justice to his. I'm particularly reminded of the way Sassoon in the film takes exception to all the praise he receives, but especially to the idea that he is courageous, and the rather stunning courage of Davies' directorial approach here, in which he lets scenes go far longer than a conventional American production would allow, because he knows the power of slowness. And he does 100 unfashionable things, dissolves, voiceover, splicing in old news footage, because he trusts their power. The sequences of pure image underscored by readings of Sassoon's poems or by music separate the movie's dramatic scenes the way dreams separate days. Davies is rewarded for every choice. It's just wonderful. Irma Vep, 1996, directed by Olivier Assayas. Review date April 23rd, 2023. First and only viewing. Few movies about movie making cradle you like this one does in the fever dream that the people involved are sharing. Between this and Shadow of the Vampire, there's a case to be made that the best movies about making movies are the ones that most potently translate the madness of ambition that it takes to do something so insane, and make you understand that every time a movie actually gets completed and released, it's a miracle. Assayas achieves one of the most intuitive and grounded naturalistic styles I've ever seen. It's almost all tight rooms, the camera close to everyone because there is no way to back up. And the effect is that the camera eye is like that of a curious ghost haunting the film production, smoothly slipping around and in between everyone to catch every last little thing, of which there are so wonderfully many, what with how thoughtful the actors are about the details of their performances. The relationships in the movie are beautifully drawn, revealing that summer camp meets wartime vibe of people who don't know each other, thrown together in a hurry, and forced to collaborate in support of a unified artistic vision. The energy of all these scenes on set is spot on, and Assayas's close framings lend just the right feeling of pressurized intimacy. By natural extension, all the questions the movie raises about art and commerce, the hellish crossroads that motion pictures have always called home, come across with just the right touch because they're not emphasized and backlit in the plot situations. They're instead just there, by necessity, at the heart of all the characters' neuroses, and they come out in jagged, anxious bursts during all the little fights and laughing fits and moments of quiet, the way all feelings do when you're trying to hold them in so that you can get through your work day. Maggie Cheung is simply a stunning presence. It's adorable that Renee, the director of the film within the film, chose the project entirely as a pretext to let the camera worship her for 90 minutes, and that's pretty much exactly what Assayas did, too. Vanya on 42nd Street, 1994, directed by Louis Malle. Review date August 19th, 2025, second viewing. Among the best attempts ever made to invade a theatrical production with a movie camera, partly because the Andre Gregory Wallace Shawn workshop conception here lent itself so beautifully to intimacy, partly because it turned out that Chekhov's text throbs twice as hard when it's executed at such a short distance, and partly because Malle made every camera choice count for as much as it possibly could within these premises. It's a thing of beauty right from the start, the wonder of following the actors off the teeming street and into this busted palace and watching the play just melt into being, the derelict theater with crumbling ceiling offering itself up so humbly as Chekhov's setting, the line of its beginning so soft and fuzzy that anyone who didn't know Uncle Vanya might not realize it had begun until the reverse shot of the audience. It's marvelous that the actors complain about being tired when they're filing in. They couldn't be more perfectly prepared. Wallace Shawn lies down on a bench before you've found out what role he's playing, so it isn't obvious that he's taken his place. For all you know, he might just be getting in a few winks. It's probably a deliberate joke, and it's a good one. It's enchantment with drama of the special variety that, as in Renoir's The Golden Coach, can only be achieved when the frames hung around artifice, the containers of performance, are acknowledged and celebrated. Your knowledge that they're only actors makes what they're doing all the more beautiful. It is their task and their training to perform emotions on command, but an actor's emotions are tapped, not faked. You're not pretending to cry when the tears in your eyes are real. It's for our sake that they do this. It's to activate our feelings. And short of doing it yourself, only a movie that offers this kind of closeness can awaken you to this understanding of the tender sacrifice of acting. Every performer is uniquely splendid, each filled to the top with their character's own perverse dignity. But the two women in the lead cast, Brooke Smith and Julianne Moore, are especially magnificent. Smith doing Sonia as a bruise larger than the size of her body, and Moore doing Yelena like a doll that has been broken and repaired to a state of new fragility. The two women of totally different circumstances, with lives of totally different shapes, who are united in starvation. Both of them forever a second away from screaming or from shutting down for good. Their scenes together are thunderingly alive. But Malle animates everything, and I mean in the divine sense. not just the physical closeness, but the constancy of handheld, with the frame wobbling and tilting ever so slightly, ever so often, makes the camera not an objective eye, but a breathing, chuckling, sighing observer, a whole extra person, not watching, but involved. Equally extraordinary are the moments when we get a close-up of a character who is not speaking, someone we might have been content to ignore in favor of the speaker, but who, because this cast is so special, is fully engaged in their character's reaction. Maul pulls us into their listening ears, something the theater could not do without overblown effects like spots. The effect is never not moving, and is frequently the thing that takes a scene to its saddest place. I was on the verge of tears this entire viewing and never got my release. That's exactly how you're supposed to feel coming out of Uncle Vanya. Nobody said life was a rose garden. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find these and more than 1,000 of my other reviews in writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. I'm Will Hatman, and I'll keep watching if you do.
You got the hook.